Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our view returns to Australia's favourite asset class, property. Australian house prices have posted their sharpest monthly increase in February since August 2003, with reports that the market is now entrenched in one of its strongest growth phases on record. The increase was widely spread around the nation, with every capital city posting an increase and regional markets also jumping. Record low home loan rates in conjunction with pandemic stimulus and raised expectations for the economy in the post-COVID world appears to be the key drivers, as owner-occupiers are now ruling the auction day roost. On the flip side, with international borders likely to remain effectively shut for most of this year, and many landlords are now reaching the end of loan deferral periods with their banks, there still lies ahead the potential for forced selling. So now the question remains, will the tight supply continue to pull up prices? Can Australia's world-leading household debt levels support yet another expansion? And can this post-COVID fervour be sustained? Joining us on today, we are lucky to have friend of the show, Dr. Cameron Murray. Cameron is an economist and consultant who specialises in property markets, environmental economics and corruption. He is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Sydney, blogs at fresheconomicthinking.com and is co-author of The Game of Mates. Some listeners may remember we had Cam on the show in May of last year presenting the bull case for Australian property, and safe to say he jumped at the chance to get back on again this year. So Dr. Cameron Murray, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Great to have you back. Here to share his thoughts on Australian property in 2021, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And finally, joining us also on today, we have our bear-turned-bull chief economist, Leith Van Onselen. G'day to you, Leith.
Yeah, g'day, Tim. Hello, everyone.
And just a quick reminder that before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And we will be also having the ability to answer any questions in the YouTube chat. Obviously not live this time, but we can answer those as well if you'd like to pop them in there. So let's jump into our agenda for today. So I'm going to kick off with, obviously, as I kicked off the intro there, the strongest growth in property prices since 2003, and a bit to cover there. Mortgage market booming, auction market also booming, chat around the lack of supply, a vision then of turning our thoughts to how long the boom can run, and then finally wrapping it up in our investment outlook and how we may use these themes every day here in the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth. So perhaps we'll kick off with an Australian property market update. Over to you, Cam.
Thanks, guys. Well, if you've been paying attention, the market has surprised many commentators in the last 12 months. By just booming. We're looking at annual price growth of 4% in Brisbane and a little bit more in Hobart and Perth. So it's very unexpected, given that 12 months ago we were all here panicked about unemployment, household incomes, mortgage holidays, and all those sorts of things. And if I recall, I said at the time, there's a lot of global momentum around. People who are likely to lose their jobs from this type of shock are not in the home buying pool. They're not likely buyers. So the fact that they lost their job doesn't change the home buying market much. And a few other things. And we've seen that played out. And the big point that I think is happening not just here but globally is the asset repricing that's going on that reflects the new era of rock bottom interest rates. And I think that has a little bit further to go. And so you can see that in the data with the refinances, the first home buyers jumping in. I think, Leith, you mentioned the latest data on first home buyer lending is one of the few data points in history where it exceeded investor lending for housing. So first home buyers have really ramped it up. And that makes sense because outside of Sydney and Melbourne, it's cheaper to borrow money from the bank to buy a house than borrow the house from the landlord by paying rent. And when that makes, when that's cheaper, anyone who can get a loan is going to make the decision to jump in and buy until prices rise such that that, that choice is no longer the obvious one. So you've got some slides that show just what I'm talking about. Record mortgage demand, particularly first home buyers. And the thing to keep in mind is that the historical correlation there is mortgage balances are the fuel for price changes. And so I don't think we're going to escape that reality this time around either. What else is interesting for you?
Well, actually, I think it's probably one of those is worth exploring. I think it's certainly the headline amount. If you just compare your rent to your if you just compared straight up your rent to your mortgage, that's obviously that's cheaper at the moment, as you said, in mm-hmm. a number of cities, mm-hmm. and which. Our sort of stats sort of show it does vary quite widely from city to city mm-hmm. over time, and you do tend to find that Sydney and Melbourne are prepared to pay. Sydney seems to be sort of, if you're paying 100% of your 100% seems to be the bottom where they're both equal, and then people are prepared to pay 200% at the top in terms of what the mortgage payment compared to the rent. But there are actually a lot of other costs that in terms of home ownership that don't get caught in that, and so so you can certainly equal it out. But as you said, most people are pretty much just looking at the one figure and not doing the maths behind that. But having said that, I guess what I'm interested in is the household formation part. So mm-hmm. so I've had so many new first home buyers. Mm-hmm. Do you have any feel for whether this is people sort of moving out of home, from their parents and buying a house? Have we got, I guess, people buying second houses? I've got my place in the city and I'll buy somewhere on the coast so I can, when there's a lockdown, so I can get away or whatever. Do you think it's sort of new household formation, or do you think, because I guess we've had this big supply coming through, and I'm just trying to, interested in seeing how you see the two marry up.
Okay, I'll answer that and then remind me to go back to that rent versus buy cost comparison.
Yeah, yep, okay.
The way I see that is, I don't actually know what the balance of those effects are, whether it's renters becoming home buyers, so on net investors are selling rather than sort of buying compared to homeowners, and I don't know how much is new households forming. All I can say is that the incentives for all of those groups are the same, which is to go and borrow some money and buy a house. Go and borrow at 2% and buy one to avoid paying 4.5% on the rent.
Yep.
So I don't know the composition. And you mentioned supply as in, and I think if I understand correctly, you're referring to the last sort of wave of home building.
Mm.
And the current, so the last wave was really apartment driven inner city areas, Brisbane City, Melbourne. And the new wave is detached housing. Boosted by the home builder grant or whatever it's called. So yes, people are shifting out and into those new dwellings. A lot of home buyers will go from renting to building and buying. That's surely part of it. I don't know how big, but my expectation is in the next census, we'll actually see an increase in the home ownership rate, something that declined for the first 15 years of the 21st century. I actually think the census is next year, if I'm correct. And the effect of this wave we've seen in the last 12 months and might still see for the rest of this year is going to reverse that trend of the proportion of homeowners. So it declined from a peak of 70 down to about 65%, roughly. and it might bounce up a couple of percent because of this huge adjustment that's going on right now.
Mm. And you think at the headline level, it does look as if it's basically people moving out of apartments where they were renting and leaving vacancies there and into houses and pushing prices up there. Is that?
Yeah, I think...
It's not just that, though. It's also we've had a whole bunch of young adults living at home for an extended period. So there is a lot of pent up demand there. And I think to Damien's point, I think there is actually quite a lot of household formation. So household formation comes from two areas. It comes from obviously net overseas migration. That's new people coming into the country. It also mm-hmm. comes from when you've got multi-generational families or a whole bunch of adults bunching together at home, typically young Australian adults at uni or whatever, and they move out of home and form their own households. I think we're getting a lot of that at the moment. And you can see that by the really strong owner-occupied mortgage demand, which is up 44% year on year. First home buyers is up about 70%. I think there is actually a fair bit of pent-up demand, new household formation going on as young adults leave home. And to Cam's point, it makes sense when you've got gross rental yields outside of Sydney and Melbourne well over 4%, and you can borrow at 2%, as low as 2% on a fixed mortgage. So the whole rent versus buy equation is skewed towards buying outside of Sydney and Melbourne, of course. And that's part of the reason why we've got such insatiable mortgage demand, particularly in places like Perth and Brisbane. And we've got, obviously prices growing most strongly in those smaller capital cities as well as regional areas. This is a coast-to-coast boom. It's across every single capital city. It's across every single region. It's the broadest boom we've seen since the post-GFC experience. And it's been driven by owner occupiers rather than investors, which is quite unusual. It only happened one other time in recorded history, which was for a very brief period after the post-GFC when they implemented massive first-home buyer grants. So there's a lot of parallels there.
Maybe I should actually take one step back and just tell you where I guess I'm leading with this. Because I guess... Mm-hmm. I'm trying to work out how long this is going to go on for.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one part which is saying there's some pent up demand. There's people who maybe that's your point there is that there's a lot of people who should be in their own houses, but they've been locked out of houses by high prices and higher interest rates. And so they're now this is a chance to move out from mum and dad. But given the net overseas migration and the building, sort of as you said, the building wave was focused on apartments and mm-hmm. And people are wanting houses now. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just trying to work out. Okay, well, how much? There's some friction which is forcing prices higher. And then it's a question of okay, well, can we get supply into this area? Because there's a lot of regions where, especially some of the smaller regional areas, where you see these massive jumps in prices and you're like, there's acres and acres and acres of land, mm-hmm. all around these smaller towns. There's nothing stopping them other than government policies from expanding. If we see a home keeper home builder boom for 12 months that sort of takes the heat out of that market, does that mean then it starts sliding away? Because if you've disaggregated everyone and they're all regional, then you can much more easily handle supply, I guess. Or are we in this, here's a permanent phase? Because I do think if inflation doesn't get doesn't come back, and I don't think it will, that they can push interest rates lower. And so, maybe we're in this permanent upswing. So we're not permanent, but it's a couple of year upswing.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a couple of years we're looking at. Because by the time, and Cam will probably test, I'll let you talk in mm-hmm. a sec, Cam, rather than stealing your oxygen. But, the whole supply issue is a bit of a slow-moving feast. So by the time, we are probably overbuilding now with all home builder and obviously all the apartments that were still being completed from yesteryear. But that's really a problem for, probably late 2022, 2023, if immigration's not rebooted. And I don't think it's going to move the needle on prices in the short term or even, short to medium term. That's probably more like a longer term factor. So I don't think it's going to have much impact. At the moment, it's cheap money. It's cheap credit.
Yeah.
And the huge differential between, buying and renting. And I don't think it's going to change until the rental yields come right down, you know, sort of equalise with mortgage rates, and that only happened through price rises.
Yeah, okay. I agree with pretty much all that, Leith. And let me just give you my picture on the supply question and the adjustments that are going on. My general view is that there is no supply issue. There never has been, and that the rate of construction is irrelevant. Like it's just such a minor effect on either prices or rents that you can just about ignore it, except over a 30 plus year period. So let me give you an example. Leith mentioned the word overbuilding, and maybe we've overbuilt apartments and whatnot, but just remember, each year we only build about 1.5% of the stock. And so you can overbuild a few years and maybe you've got 1% more stock. So you've got an extra 100,000 dwellings, because there's around 10 million dwellings. All it takes is one person to move out of 1% of the dwellings. One in 100 people who have four people living there now have three. And all those dwellings are occupied. The effects are so small compared to, you know, price moves of 10%+ in 1 year. And if we look in Sydney, for example, apartment rents are the same as they were 8 years ago in nominal terms. So there's been, if anything, more than enough supply. Apartment rents have been falling for 4 years, and now prices are launching. And it can't be a product of the quantity of dwellings that exist. It can only be a product of the quantity of those that are for sale and who and the amount being bought and sold. And just remember, if it makes sense to buy a house because of the investment proposition, it makes sense not to sell. So if I'm an investor, I've got a house earning 4.5% yield at the current market price, which obviously I didn't pay because I bought it years ago. Why would I cash that out so that I'm left with all this cash that I have to go and find a return on when I know I'm getting 4.5% plus the likely price rises given the adjustment that's occurring? It is the highest returning option for that value in my balance sheet right now. And so you have the case, you hear, for example, reporting in the US and Canada right now of builders saying, well, you know, I've stopped selling because I make more money not building houses. Yeah. And I want to sell next year, not this year.
Yeah. And the US is different though, in that they're building still miles below what it was sort of 2006, 2005 type level. So
yeah, all of that is irrelevant in my view.
Well, it's actually captured in the data, Cam. So, like the listings, the real estate listings at the moment are at record lows.
And that's true everywhere in the world right now, by the way. That's one thing I keep trying to remind myself and others, is that we can look at local factors and look at adjustments and look at supply in apartments versus houses, but the whole world is booming. German prices went up 70% in the last 10 years. Sydney prices went up. Australian prices went up 40%.
New Zealand's going up, 20%.
New Zealand went up 20% last year.
Yeah.
And none of this has anything to do with those sort of long-term slow adjustments to the many tens of millions of dwellings that currently exist. In my view.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying supply and demand doesn't matter.
It's more that it takes a long time.
But there's
a difference between structural demand and supply versus market demand and supply. And at the moment, market supply, which is actual home for sale, is incredibly low. It is as tight as it's ever been.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm not arguing that case. I guess what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put together the picture of how this is going to change over time. And so, and if there is extraordinary demand for houses because more people can afford to now move out that couldn't afford to before, or more household formation will happen, mm-hmm. I guess is the big thing. Then and we don't see interest rates going up, then you can sort of see that you can see that lasting for a lot longer than if it's a a shorter term, how can I put this? It's just shorter term supply demand imbalance. That's basically saying yes, we've got a structural thing where we've got a lot of people now wanting to move out of apartments and into houses, and that's forcing rents in that's forcing rents down in units, and it's forcing prices up in houses. And it's a shorter term one. As more houses get built, then eventually that evens out, and all rents fall until the stage where people start saying, well, actually, you know what? If it's got to cost me half as much to rent, maybe I'll rent in an apartment rather than a house. Yeah. You get some equalization that way.
But just remember, people buy the house before they build it, typically. It's a build-to-order thing. So everyone who's out there getting home builder has, in a way, they're in the home buyer statistics, and their home is getting built. You know, it's not going to adjust any more than the commitments being made, if you know what I mean. Like, the supply adjustment it's already occurred through those purchases of new dwellings.
Yeah, but they're also, they'll either live in somewhere at the moment that they might sell, or they'll move out of that place and rent it. So
That's right. But those are such small parts of the total stock. Like, it's just a grain of sand in a beach full of millions and millions of houses.
I think that's probably overplaying it. But I've made your point as well to others, so I'm not against that. I've never used a grain of sand on the beach, because I think that's overstating it. But as you said, it's 1% change. It's not a lot of change in the demand for people. So the net effect still comes back to saying, well, we need to. It's getting a feel for. It basically sounds like what you're saying, and I'm not 100% sure I agree with everything, but I agree with the central premise is that interest rates are the only thing that really matters.
Because
it's the price of and the relative cost of rents
on the whole supply and household formation thing. I mean, obviously, you know, we know buyer demand's going through the roof, and that's picked up in the mortgage statistics. But the other thing to note is that rents are actually rising very quickly as well outside of Sydney and Melbourne apartments. Mm-hmm. And that there is also a sign of household formation, because, you know, you've got obviously kids or whatever moving out of home, buying houses, which is pushing up home buyer demand. But at the same time, you've got demand as in excess demand for rental properties is also rising because rents are booming. So we've got this situation where in the past couple of months, rental yields have actually been going up because rents are rising faster than dwelling values.
In some places, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, outside of Sydney and Melbourne, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this gets back to, I guess we'll probably get on this in a sec, but how long can this last? Well, at the moment, the boom's been driven by owner-occupiers and first home buyers. Well, I can see a situation where investors are crazy not to get in now because they can borrow cheap. Like, investor can borrow for 3% variable, 2.5% fixed. They can get a gross rental yield outside of Sydney and Melbourne of well over 4%, and rents are rising quickly, so their income's going to go up. So, you know, I can see a baton change, and this is what happened post GFC, where the first home buyers drove the market initially, and then they hand the baton over to investors, and then over. And I think that's going to happen again.
Can you define quickly? I guess that's what I'm like. So on your charts, we're saying Brisbane 4%, Adelaide 4%. I mean, Darwin and Perth are obviously growing. I'd say, yes, are growing quickly. But would you say that, you know, rental strong growth in Canberra?
Look, house rent growth is well above incomes or inflation at the moment. So, and you can see it's ticking up everywhere. It's got a hockey stick going north, not south.
But I'd like to say, I guess what I'm saying is a hockey stick doesn't mean it's going to rise forever now. I'm trying to work out what the limits are. And I would say, if we're saying houses are rising in, say, Canberra, Adelaide, Brisbane at 4 to 5%, and but units are, Brisbane 0.5%, Canberra, Adelaide 2%. Mm-hmm. So you might average it out at 3%. You're like, yeah, okay, it's not weak growth, but it's not. You know, in respect of saying we've got an inflation target of 2 to 3%, and it's sitting at the top end of the inflation target, it's not. Yeah.
I guess I'm looking at it from an investor's point of view. At the moment, investors are barely in the market. They're running at levels that are about a third less than the 2015 peak. Talking about mortgages here. So
but you can't make an investment that's not a 10-year, like you can't flip into property and flip out again. You can't say, okay, I'm gonna do a 1 year. Yeah, but if you're on a 1 year, you're gonna lose 10% of your stuff down to all your fees and costs and everything on the way in and out.
So I guess
what I'm saying is if you're telling people to buy now as an investor, you need to have a five to ten year view that this thing's gonna keep going for 5 to 10 years. And you're not going to be stuck with an illiquid asset at the wrong part of the cycle.
Or alternatively, you buy knowing that you're going to get 2 or 3 strong years growth, and then after that it'll just be, weaker growth.
Doesn't really matter. Yeah, and I'm comfortable with that. But I guess what I'm saying is, I feel like saying we're in a much stronger growth perspective than anyone would have thought, or not anyone, but Cam.
Except for Cam and Chris Cam Troy. give him a pat on the back.
I guess I'm nervous about telling people, Leith, to go out and buy houses if you don't have a 5 to 10 year view on it.
Okay.
Because I flip into a house today, it rises 10%, I get myself a 5% yield, I go and sell it, and I may or may not break even on the whole deal after I've paid all my, depending upon, stamp duties and taxes and all that other type of stuff. So I guess that's where I'm coming from.
Okay. Oh, totally. Look, honestly, I'd never tell anyone to buy a house unless it was, something they want to do. But at the same time, if you've been renting for ages and you're sick of renting, you're on 1 year leases, etc., you can safely say it's not a bad time.
So rental growth, are you expecting strong rental growth to continue? That's what I'm asking.
So I'll give, from my view, is that the rental growth we're seeing is a product of the redistribution of household incomes geographically. And so you're getting a lot of people relocating and taking their high incomes, for example, to Byron Bay or the Gold Coast or the Sunshine Coast. Mm. And they're coming from Sydney, Melbourne, inner city Brisbane, and going, look, I may as well get the best house. And so they're sort of adding to that income pool to bid up rents. So my general view is that rents are almost purely income driven. And so that's what we're seeing mostly. And people's incomes are pretty solid. The hundreds of billions of dollars of stimulus is in people's bank accounts, and it feels like income to them.
Yeah. Okay. And so are you expecting this to continue then?
That was a question for mine as well, from that demand, longevity point of view. Are we just seeing a bit of a blip in, some latent demand for people who wanted to move regionally? And obviously this whole COVID working from home experience, has been pushed into the Australian way of life. So they've taken advantage, shifted out into the coastal regions or wherever they want to move to. And obviously that's going to then, that demand push is going to subside over the next 12 months unless we have another pandemic and the next wave of people shift out. So, that was a good question.
So on the rents, I almost think it doesn't matter to the investment proposition whether they go up 10% or down 10% in the next 5 years, because that takes your yield from 4.5 to 2 or something, depending on costs and whatnot, right? You wipe off a little, and that's from a huge panicked shock. So rental prices in Sydney for apartments have only just fallen 10% with combination of COVID, the massive supply boom and everything else. So seeing that sort of level on average in suburbia of rental declines, that's a pretty big change. So my view is it almost doesn't really matter. They just move so much slower.
Yeah. That sounds like a reason to buy. I'm buying Tesla because it doesn't really matter about the profits. It's all about
I'm just giving you the proportions, right? So you're making 25 grand on a year in gross income and rents fall to 23, but you've got $1 million house going up in value 5% a year, 50 grand or whatever for a few years.
Yeah.
Does that really matter that you didn't get a few grand for
it? It's interesting you're an economist and you're saying, and you're basically saying for the value of the house, it doesn't actually matter how much you can, what cash flow the house generates. And I guess that's where I sort of go, eventually it does matter.
No,
and as you describe sort of assets that go through that part where, yes, you can make money on the thing and borrow, you know, you go through that phase and then you start getting to the stage where the Ponzi scheme, where it doesn't matter what the cash flow is. I'm just trying to find somebody else to flip this to.
Well, I mean, it doesn't when you're getting 4.5% return, you can borrow 80% at 2%, right? Like, the relativity of that effect on your overall economic return of combined capital gains and net incomes is so low right now. And that's why first-time buyers are jumping in. And the other thing I think you mentioned before is this liquidity and, you know, it's important to worry about the cycle because you might get 10% capital growth in a few years and you'll get your 4% yield, but then there's a collapse and what happens? You know, you're stuck with this asset. I'm like, yeah, but you're stuck with an asset making 5% that's worth 100 grand more than what you paid. And if the economy collapses, you'll be paying 0% on your mortgage. Like the whole structure of the economy is engineered to rescue you.
There's a key point.
So like, you know, the property falls when there's some reason everyone has to panic at once. And so few people have bought at these high prices. So if you think pre-GFC time in the US, it was super high leverage on low incomes of people buying multiple houses and huge turnover so that there was this big pool of people, you know, 15% of owners had bought in the last few years in a highly leveraged paying recent prices. But that's not the case now because turnover's, you know, a third of what it was. Prices have already made big gains or have been, you know, relatively stable the last 5 years outside of Sydney and Melbourne. And so I just, you know, you go up the stairs and out the window with property prices, right? And so I just, you know, can't see that critical mass of highly leveraged people. I mean, everyone who bought 5 years ago is paying half the interest rate since they bought.
Oh, look, yeah, no, I think that's...
So they're not going to be in a hurry to sell, right?
Yeah, and for me, our biggest concern 12 months ago was actually that at some stage, you'd have to start telling people, you know what, you've lost your job, you've got to start paying your mortgage, or you've got to sell it. And that hasn't happened. And I think the part of that was, as the vaccines hit sort of at a good point, now there's a reason to just keep extending these things until we've got herd immunity. And so, you know, you've basically wiped out the people, anyone who might have had to be a forced seller, you've sort of said, okay, they don't have to be anymore.
Yeah.
So that's sort of...
That's also
kind of Cam's point though. Like the housing's too big to fail, and the government basically bailed out anyone, extended their mortgages, created mortgage rates, whatever, brought in the term funding facility so they can get mortgages even lower, et cetera. And if we have some sort of meltdown again, well, we'll probably get negative interest rates and mortgages will come down, you know, just 1%. And it'll happen all over again. And then same time, if the economy recovers strongly and rates stay and hold or even go up a little bit, you're going to have booming, we're going to have incomes going up and et cetera. So I'm not saying it's, you know, you can't lose, but it's the whole structure of the economy is pretty much now all based around supporting housing.
So how long can it last is the question we need to
to maximum 2 years ahead because it's pretty pointless doing that anyway. And even 2 years ahead is probably too long. But I think it can certainly run for the next 2 years based on the fact that mortgage rates are unlikely to go up much, if at all, and maybe even come down. And rental yields are so juicy outside of Melbourne and Sydney that until those yields get down to closer to the mortgage rate and we start to get affordability concerns, that it can keep running. Although I do think Sydney and Melbourne won't run nearly as hard or as far because it's already so much more expensive and yields suck.
Yeah.
And I think we will get this baton change from first home buyers, and probably in 6 months to a year, we'll start getting complaints that first home buyers are getting shut out and they can't afford and investors are taking over. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened post GFC. First home buyers started the boom with all the home buyer grants, et cetera, and then the investors took over. And I think we'll probably get that again because because of the whole borrowing versus rent equation so favourable. And also the investors will see that there's good prospects for capital growth, that rents have grown at a decent pace. It's a pretty good proposition when there's not many other places to put your money.
So I think it's more like 2003 to 2004, this current period we're in, where we had a few years, big run up in Sydney, not so much in Melbourne. And then Sydney dropped off for 4 years, really. So maybe we're a little bit after that, 2005, 2006 period. Sydney dropped off and everywhere else took off. And it was like a rocket in Perth, in Brisbane, Adelaide, everywhere. This ripple effect away from the capitals. And that was also part of a synchronized global boom that went on as well in the 2005 period. Yeah. So you'd seen this previous wave of Sydney peaking in 2003. So that's the sort of the equivalent of 2018 now. A couple of years quiet in Sydney, and then a rocket elsewhere, synchronized with all of regional Canada, the US, UK. And that's what's happening now. And if you're an old school Georgist looking at your calendar, you'll see that's like an 18-year type of cycle. So there, you know, that sort of, these old school Georgists with their long-term cycle view really think we've got to wait till 2025 to 2026 to see the top come in. And so between now and then, like Leith said, first home buyers will drop off, investors will come in, we'll have arguments about that. We will probably even also raise the interest rate a little. We'll start the ratchet up again.
That was my next question. So let's say rates rose from where we are, zero now to 1%. So, put it another way, actually, if the TFF stopped, yeah, and rates would rise 1.5%.
Yeah, they're not going to rise 1.5%. It'll go up in 0.25% increments.
But I guess what I'm saying with the TFF, yeah. So let's say they ratcheted the TFF. Well, let's say the TFF, they said, you know, okay, we're all done now. We've sorted that out. You know, employment's back. We can now put the TFF back. We can get rid of the TFF. And so now you've got to pay the standard variable rate. And so you jump.
I don't think they will do that. Yeah.
No. Because the market couldn't handle it.
Because you know, the Reserve Bank wants to smooth expectations and go, oh, we're getting worried, guys. See, we ratcheted things up. Please don't borrow too much.
But let's say they ratchet up over 18 months.
Yeah, yeah. A percent over 18 months could happen. I totally agree. And the boom will keep going until the effect of that is to catch up the mortgage rate to the yield. So if people are borrowing at 2%, it goes up to 3%. It's still 4.5% yields in lots of places. So, you know, it will accelerate the demise of the bubble, or it'll knock the top off compared to had they kept it. But I think it's only going to happen in a sort of globally synchronized way as well. I don't think the RBA wants to boost interest rates if the rest of the world doesn't, and watch the
absolutely not. And they want the yield, they want them lower, you know. They want the dollar lower. So I'm not suggesting the end of the interest rate cycle by any means. But I guess what I'm trying to test out from you is that, and I do, like, you know, we obviously run our property calculator and the buy to rent and all that type of stuff on there, and mm-hmm. Exactly what you're saying is our major input is saying, what's your mortgage payment compared to your full-time wages, and what's your mortgage payment compared to rent, and that will determine you know, where house prices will go, and then it's some sort of multiple of that, and you know, Sydney houses will go from 100% of that to 200% over the course of a cycle.
Yeah,
but there are other factors, I guess, that are making it, and especially with such a high level of debt where we are now, you're basically beholden, as you said, to central banks and governments supporting you the whole way. Mm-hmm. And if it's policy error that's gonna unwind you.
Well, I mean, it's not gonna last a decade. I feel like that's crazy talk. But I think it's going to last at least 3 more years globally. And during those 3 years, we will see central banks having to turn course, because things will boom. The amount of stimulus that's going to come globally as everyone's opened up is going to be off the charts. Activity will pick up, and they will see reasons to ratchet up the rate and go, oh yeah, we've hit our inflation target now. Unemployment's, you know, on a really good trajectory. So I think that's going to happen. On the rent buy, like, how high can prices go relative to the repayment costs? You know, your ratio is 1 to 2 for Sydney. So you can pay twice as much in interest as the rent, essentially, and that's still within the range of where things get to.
Where it's been. Well, it peaks at 200. It doesn't say 200.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how entrenched do those expectations of further growth get in the pricing? So once you get above 1, you're only paying a premium above the cost of renting because you want exposure to that capital growth. You're paying for that growth rate, you know. And as you get to 1.5, your expectation is that 50% of my gains are coming from capital growth now, and only a third of my gains are coming from capital growth, 2/3 from rent. So I'm going to pay 150 or 1.5 times the equivalent cost of renting to get those capital gains. And so I think we're going to have to see that bounce above 1.5 before we're close to the end. And probably when it does, I'll turn around and say, if you're thinking of selling, maybe consider today, as I have done in the past. So
So that sounds like, though, you know, under this scenario, then it seems like a house building boom would seem to be, although it's, you know, obviously the figures today are disappointing, as you know, but it's just people, I guess, front loading, trying to get government handouts first. But you'd have to think under this scenario that we're a pretty sustained boom for the next 2 or 3 years. If house prices are going up, then builders are going to be falling over themselves to develop and sell.
Well, maybe it's definitely the case that in the 2003 to 2007 sort of period, that construction wasn't super high. We're actually in a slight decline in building approvals for that whole period, that they sort of peaked just before the GST, and they rebounded, you know, that was a 1 year sort of blip.
Yep.
So the peak was around then. And then for the next 5 or 6 years, they gradually trended down, which I thought was quite interesting, into this quite strong market. And I think that was partly the distribution, because Sydney and Melbourne are such large shares of the housing market. But outside of there, certainly there were plenty of building activity. So the other thing that I think is going to happen, we'll see that similar sort of trend, this few years of pretty slow declining construction. And part of the reason for that is that everyone who owns a site that can be developed is also exposed to these low interest rates and would rather own the undeveloped site than get cash for it and have to go and do something with that cash. So the urgency of property developers is proportional to the interest rate. The lower the interest rate, the less they're in a hurry to transform the value of their site into cash, right? They don't want the cash. They already own an asset that they would buy with the cash. So I think that's going to be part of the mix. We're going to see low turnover, patient developers because of the low interest rate.
And also low holding costs.
Low holding costs and a gradual downtrend from this current blip in housing construction. There's something we can come back and review in a few years.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Very good.
I was going to say, I think housing construction rates are going to come down anyway, because at the moment they've been pulled forward by, mm-hmm. you know, massive stimulus with Home Builder, et cetera. And also, mm-hmm. obviously, we don't have the immigration we had in the past. which is one of the reasons why the HIA and the property council, etc., is just begging for us to reboot mass immigration to obviously backfill supply, backfill demand. But you know, as Cam said, there's also that interest rate, the interest rate situation also doesn't encourage them to build. So they've kind of got an incentive to not bother building, just watch, let their asset rise, and they manipulate the market a bit. So yeah, interesting.
Was there any note on just on auctions? I'm just sort of bouncing around a few of the charts as we've been chatting, just to give our viewers some info and a bit of something to look at while we're chatting away.
Look. The only thing to say with auctions is whether it's auctions, housing finance, they're all booming. So we've got, you know, mortgage growth running at its highest ever level, or highest recorded level. Auction clearance rates are now tracking at the very top of prior peaks, like the 2015 peak, etc. And auction clearance rates and mortgage finance are pretty good leading indicators for price growth, and both are booming, which suggests that prices in the short run will also boom. There's not really much more to say about it. It's just low stock, really high demand when it comes to auctions, really high clearance rates. And clearance rates are really only reflective of Sydney and Melbourne, because they're the two auction markets. The other markets don't really do much when it comes to auctions. But even in Sydney and Melbourne, auctions are, you know, booming as well.
And having said that though, as well, they're a lot more focused on houses than apartments.
Oh, well, absolutely. The auction market's almost exclusively houses.
So the other question is household debt. So how high can we go?
We can go much higher because the actual repayment, the amount of income going to repayments is actually down to about 2,000 levels. So it's getting down towards so interest payments and principal and interest repayments as a proportion of income are actually down, when it comes to interest payments, down to about levels of 2,000.
Yeah,
So
when you say principal plus interest, sorry, where was that at?
It's about 2003, I think. Time I checked, based on Bank for International Settlements data, and interest alone is down to about 2,000 levels. So they're both down, well down on where they were in the years before the GFC and afterwards. That would tell you that that debt can obviously go a lot higher before those repayments start becoming a problem. And it also tells you that if they do start to become a problem, what's to stop the government from going down the route of the ECB and sending, you know, interest rates in the negative and mortgage rates down to about 1%, just to then fix that situation and push mortgage repayments back down.
I get from that perspective, but you know, the ECB's, while it's had that policy for a while, it hasn't managed to get people to borrow much in terms of the, like, there seems to be a and maybe that's changed now. Maybe coronavirus is going to change that. But it hasn't managed to get the actual. If you look at the national income to amount on mortgages, it hasn't really changed in a lot of countries in Europe. Whereas Australia's managed to get people to take more debt, and we're sort of close to double a lot of those levels, those countries' levels. The question is, you know, are we closing in on the limit of how much debt we can have, or are people going to be willing to say, well, you know, we'll take a $1 million mortgage or a $2 million mortgage that I might never conceivably pay off, but the rental, you know, as you said, the rent versus interest isn't killing me, so I'll have it, and it's sort of like I'm renting it anyway. I'm just renting it from the bank.
Yeah. Look, it is rising. Germany in the last few years has seen that debt to GDP turn around and house prices boom. So I think there's, I guess you would say that, you know, the European markets are slow and adjust slowly, whereas the Aussies adjust in a hurry to the lower interest rates, for example. So I think it is going
They've had it since 2016, so they've had 5 years at it.
That's right. And the debt to GDP has grown since 2017 in Germany. That's right. So
yeah, let me get that.
So look, what's going to see the end of this cycle is when the Reserve Bank sees the uptick in activity and responds with higher interest rates, and those higher interest rates have an effect because of the larger loan balance of mortgages on the interest paid as a percentage of household income. So we'll see this, you know, really rising and obvious cost of that debt, and that will slow down slow down the buying for sure.
Sorry, I haven't actually got this chart in the slide deck, but just in terms of those numbers, so Aussie total credit to household, total credit to households versus GDP in Australia is 120-odd%.
Mm-hmm. Second highest.
Europe peaked in 2009. The Eurozone peaked in 2009 at 65% and is back to under 60. And it's maybe you could draw a line going up if you're, you know, I think maybe it's gone up 1% in the last 3 or 4 years. So I don't know if that quite possibly that a lot of that's German versus maybe that's Spain and other countries going the other way. But yeah, I guess Ireland, what I'm saying is, the Eurozone hasn't been like those low rates haven't forced them out, and that's where I'm trying to work out the limit is like we're double Australian debt to GDP, household debt to GDP is double Eurozone, it's double Japan, it's 50% higher than the US, it's 50% higher than the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like there should be a limit at some stage. Well, I'm just trying to, because I guess there's one thing to say, yes, people will go out and borrow more money and go and bid this higher, and quite possibly because our whole tax system's based around it, we will. Maybe we can get to 150%.
Yep.
But I'm just trying to work out how much of the thesis is reliant upon the fact that we will go from 120 to say 140.
We actually don't have to, because what you're actually seeing at the moment is that household debt or mortgage, the stock of mortgages outstanding actually isn't growing very much. It's actually still incredibly low. It's close to historical lows.
Hmm.
And that's because lower rates, although people are taking out more and more mortgages,
yep.
Those who already have mortgages are repaying them really quickly. So we've effectively got churn. So those who already have mortgages are taking advantage of low rates and they're repaying them really quickly, which is reducing household debt. But that's been offset by obviously new mortgages coming on board, and it's only the new mortgages that drives the housing market and drives house prices. Those who are already in the market, already own a house, and are just paying back their mortgages more quickly, they don't have any impact on house prices. So, you know, we could have a situation where mortgage demand keeps booming, but actual mortgage debt is barely increasing because so many people already have mortgages are paying them back really quickly, and I think that's what you're going to get from these lower rates, and we have been seeing that.
I think that's a probable outcome, because keep in mind, turnover of housing is also very low. Rather than 5% of houses being sold in a year, it's going to be down at 1% to 2%. So the number of new mortgages is going to be relatively low compared to those sort of 45% of households who have a mortgage that they're now paying off at rapid speed because of the low rates. One other final differentiating factor for Australia is the superannuation. Now, as you may or may not know, I bought a house last year on my own advice and leveraged into the Brisbane market. And one of the questions the bank asks is your superannuation balance. And I think, you know, as the first time home borrowers are being a bit older, and they're seeing that balance, I'm literally just offsetting it off my mortgage. I'm sitting here going, well, you know, I'm going to get that money at 60. If I have a mortgage left, then boom, it's gone. The balance sheet as a whole is how I sort of consider my funding situation. So I think a lot of people who are also in those older sections, older sort of cohorts, in their 40s, looking down, oh, well, this mortgage is 25, 30 years, but I'm getting my super in 15 or 20, I'll be fine. So, you know, just another little quirk of Australia that probably is not a common factor globally, but worth keeping in mind in terms of those new buyers and how they're sort of assessing the rent buy.
And probably much, as much so from the bank as from even the person's perspective, is the bank's, if you know, if you're going to turn around and say, yeah, I'd like to, I'm 45 and I'd like a 30-year mortgage, they're like, well,
yeah,
you're going to be working in 20 years, so.
Correct. But if you've got a few hundred grand in your super already,
they can
you're happy. And, you know, the whole policy structure is incentivizing, take a big mortgage, get your lump sum super, pay that off, spend the rest, get on the age pension. But we can talk about that another time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's incentives that we're giving people incentives in their tax system, and then surprise, they're taking them.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay, great. So look, I've just been sort of trying to move on. We've finished up with the how long can the boom last charts, Leith. Are we pretty happy we've covered off on most of them in our chats today, or did you need me to zero in on any?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit there, mate. I think we've covered everything.
Yeah. Can I finish on the question of, we've been very optimistic about where prices are going, but that's more of a prediction based on all the patterns we're seeing in the data, right? It's not my view on what good public policy is. So there's a difference between opining about where you think the market's going and what's likely to happen and what is a good policy direction. And a lot of people, you know, get confused. Why are you talking up the market? I'm like, I'm explaining why I think the market, you know, the housing prices are going to go up. I don't want them to go up, even though deep inside I've just leveraged into a house. I'm quite comfortable with that situation. But, you know, I think from a public policy setting, how do we have high home ownership, secure housing, low housing costs relative to incomes, you know, equalizing the incomes of landlords and workers in many ways. You know, these are discussions we need to keep having, because when that next cycle, when this cycle finishes, perhaps that's the time that those policies can be enacted. Because in the meantime, with nearly 60-something percent, nearly 70% of people owning or buying a home, everyone's just celebrating the price rises. Well, everyone who's politically influential is celebrating the price rises. But, you know, when the baby boomers are retired and they, you know, they no longer are worried about their kids' inheritance and their whatnot, maybe that's the time at the end of the next cycle with the demographic change, another 5 years, another cycle.
So you think the baby boomers caring about the young people is what's going to change the cycle, did you say, Cameron? Is it?
Look, I think they're all going to die. Basically, so remember that
we're all going to die. Yes,
everything they own when they die, someone else is going to own.
Absolutely,
and a lot of those estates will have to be split up, because the boomers with the most houses are going to have the kids with the most houses.
Yeah,
and do they really want, you know, another 10 investment properties, or are they going to split those up? I don't know, but it's a slow burning thing coming down the pipeline for the end of this decade.
And as a generational thing, you know, there was a difference as well between, you know, 50 years ago, somebody died and left their house to their kids, and the chances were the kids were maybe in their 40s or 50s, and they might have had three or four of them or five of them to split it between. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, chances are the kids are in the 60s or 70s themselves, and they might only have one or two.
That's right.
And so there's, you know, it's much more concentration between in that wealth anyway. So
yeah. So that's just another sort of, you know, I think this cycle is baked in, but at the end of this cycle, we'll get to have I think there'll be a political opportunity to reconsider housing policy, with the boomers having aged another five or whatever years, and their children maybe becoming a bit more politically potent, and prices being wherever they are, and another wave of first home buyers. So look, I'm trying to be optimistic about where things can go, because I don't see any policy change happening in the next 4 or 5 years.
Oh, no. So, I mean, and you know, Labor's only just recently backflipped on it. Or no, you know, I guess just basically said, no, we're not gonna prosecute the negative gearing.
Might be breaking up a little bit there, Cam.
Pardon me?
Oh, no, you're back.
I'm back.
Sorry, I missed that last sentence.
I was just saying, that was me. Sorry, that was me just saying that Labor's just turned on negative gearing in the last couple of weeks. And so, you know, it's probably at least another election cycle, or probably two or three away from considering whether they should do something on property again. You'd think.
And the fact of the matter is, we had a great opportunity to make some changes, obviously, at the 2019 election, and people voted against it. So certainly nobody can accuse us or Cam of trying to affect good policy change to housing, but unfortunately, the voters voted against that, and the government's done the opposite. And so we're just talking about where we think the market will go given the current circumstances. We don't not endorsing it by any stretch. I know from my point of view, I'll keep writing about all the housing failures. I've been doing it for 10 years, and I'll keep doing it.
Yeah.
Very good. Some economic realism. I like that. All right, very good. We might jump over to the investment outlook. Damien?
I think it's worth noting that one of the key arguments about Leith and Cameron are making is effectively the same argument we're making on both equities and bonds, is that central banks, governments have basically got you back in terms of what they're going to do in terms of bailouts. In particular in Australia, the whole idea that the property is sacrosanct and you need to try and get property prices up at all costs. We spoke about the Labor Party dropping their negative gearing and this whole the whole factor and the central bank not putting on macroprudential. So this whole idea is that they want house prices to go up. I guess I just wanted to highlight though, one of the key benefits of property from this perspective is you get to gear into it. So you do get it's much easier to use debt and so you do get a leverage benefit. But there are some pretty big risks, I guess, relative to equities and bonds if you are going to go down this route in terms of looking at property. And the key one is the liquidity side. So if you think that central banks and governments have got you back and you're buying equities or you're buying bonds, and then things start to change or things start to get out of control, you can sell the next day or the same day, depending upon what you're invested in. Property is a different matter. It is an illiquid asset, and so you do need to be a lot more confident that you need to be more confident in that view. And that if you think you're going to change that view, I'd be a lot more wary about going into property from that perspective. Yeah, I'll give the very top level one for, and I guess this is flipping to share markets and bond markets in particular, is that very much inflation is the key one we'll be watching over the next 6 months. So there is a lot of inflation coming down the pipeline. We're probably going to have headline figures of 3%, maybe 4%, just from low base effects and a whole bunch of other things, which we spoke about last week and in our reports. And so really getting on top of that in terms of, is there any sustainable inflation coming, or is this just a blip where you sort of get the low base effect and then that sort of reverts back to normal? That's the key investment decision for the next 6 to 12 months, because if it's sustainable, the inflation, then there's one set of stocks you need to be buying, and you want to be out of bonds. And it means interest rates are going to be rising sooner rather than later. If it's not sustainable and it is just a one-off blip, then you should be looking at this as an opportunity to start flipping into some of those bonds and looking for that low inflation to continue. There's a different set of assets. You want more of the growth stocks and less of the value. So so we're sort of tilted very much into the value and out of the long end of the bonds, because we do think there's going to be a bit of an inflation panic, and we've seen it over the last couple of weeks coming through. There's the decision to be made over the next 6 months or 6 to 12 months as to whether that's real or not. We think we're biased towards saying it's not going to be real, but you still need to see if you get some minimum wages through in the US and you get some massive infrastructure spend and a few other factors, then maybe it will, that inflation could spark. But our thoughts at the moment is it probably won't be.
Sure thing. All right, very good. Well, look, thanks for all your time, gentlemen. We might just quickly hand over to Cam to share with our audience, of course, and listeners how they can get in contact with you or follow some of your work.
Yeah, my website is fresheconomicthinking.com. My Twitter is at Dr. Cameron Murray, all one word. That's where you'll find me most days. I'm very responsive. All my contact details are on the website.
Excellent. Yeah, no, always great following your stuff, and I think we'll be getting on the show again. Who knows what the property market looks like in the next 6 to 12 months? But I think, given all those factors, it sort of looks like it's heading in one direction. So thanks again for chiming in today, Cam and Leith, for all your insights.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.
Pleasure. Thanks to you, Damien, as well.
Thanks a lot.
Wonderful. All right, we'll jump across to our viewer question of the week. Are you a property bull or bear, and why? Feel free to drop in your thoughts in the comments in the YouTube video there. We always enjoy reading those and reflecting on those. Coming up next week, we have Adrian Redlich dropping into the office. Adrian is founder and CEO of Melbourne-based investment house Merricks Capital and has previously held senior roles at Citadel Investment Group and Merrill Lynch. Merrick's area of expertise are broad-ranging, including property lending, structured credit, agriculture, and soft commodities. And Adrian joins us to share his thoughts on all things markets and their positioning for 2021. So tune in next week, Thursday, the 11th of March at 12:30 p.m. for a well-timed update on those markets. Thanks again to all of those who have watched in for another great episode. And I hope you've taken away some great ideas. If you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. And if you'd like more of our content, feel free to head on over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. Thanks for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.